Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Every August, I attempt to attend a Sovereign Grace conference in Lexington, Kentucky. It is always the first full week of August. It's nice to go to conferences of that sort just to see that there are so many other Sovereign Grace churches and so many other men preaching Sovereign Grace. It's always a time for me to kind of charge up my batteries, and I get to go and sit and listen to other men speak and other men preach. Men who I love and trust, it's nice to be able to be fed that way. Anybody who can get free any day or night during that week. I think it's Monday the 8th through that week. So the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. That week is the conference in Lexington. And it was my intention this year to kind of go up on maybe Wednesday and stay through Friday. I try to go for the whole week usually. Wasn't sure if I could do it this week with the way my schedule's falling. And this week I got the schedule of preachers, and it turns out that Tuesday morning, first guy, me. And so I will be there Tuesday morning speaking, 9:30, and it's a great conference. If you can be there, please do. I'm very honored to be the kickoff preacher at this conference. It's a large conference, two Bible lecturers that week, one that teaches every day at 11 o'clock, and then one that teaches every evening at 6:30. Steve Wellum has been the teacher for the last 3-4 years up there, associate professor of Christian theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. Very interesting guy, very well studied. You'll learn a lot from him. One of the things I like a lot about this conference is that it's not just a preacher's conference. It is a teaching conference. There are guys who come there and teach every day so that you get a good, rich filling of teaching. And then the evening teacher is a fellow I haven't met before, Dr. Brian Chappelle, president of Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. So there'll be a lot of good teaching, a lot of good preaching. My good friend David Morris, who you know I love a lot, will be preaching on Monday evening. Tuesday evening. Monday they have a music chorale as everybody's getting into town. And then Tuesday morning it starts in earnest and goes on until Friday night. And by the end of that week, you've heard some preaching. But it's a very lively conference. I've never come away from there that I wasn't really, really thankful and glad that I had been there. So if you can make it, please do. I will hang that information on the bulletin board back there. So anybody who wants the information, pick it up. We are studying Luke, the book of Luke, verse by verse, and that takes us to chapter 21. Chapter 21 is where we're at this morning. Here at Grace Christian Assembly, we don't pass the plate. We don't take up offerings. I've had people say to me before after service, hey, you forgot to take up the offering. And we didn't forget. We just don't do that. We have a box over there on the wall, and when people feel like contributing something to the church, they contribute something by putting it in the box. We believe in giving in private, giving in secret. It's between you and God. We don't teach tithing. We don't try to pick your pocket. We don't sell you trinkets. We don't tell you if you'll send us a love gift, we'll send you a rock from Jerusalem. We don't do tricks. We tell you if you think this ministry is valuable, if you think what we're doing is of any value, that you would support it. Consequently, we're not afraid of those passages in the Bible that talk about money. And it just so happens that chapter 21 starts out with Jesus talking about money again. And it's a reality, it's a fact that Jesus talks a lot about money because money is something that all of us human beings use as an exchange of value. We determine value on the basis of money. For instance, Scott's wearing a pair of shoes. Okay, we'll call them shoes. How much did you pay for those?
$5 at a garage sale.
All right, well done. So what is the value of those shoes?
$5.
$5, exactly. If he had paid 10 bucks for them at the yard sale, what's the value?
$10.
$10. if they had been designed by Picasso and they were in a museum somewhere and somebody arbitrarily decided to spend $2 million on Scott shoes, how much are they worth?
$2 million.
$2 million, because money is how we determine value. It's an exchange of value. And so Jesus talked a lot about money. And he ties money and worship together very frequently because our English word worship, as I've told you many times, is a contraction of two old English words, worth-ship. When we worship God or when you worship anything, you are designating value to it. You're saying this thing is valuable, and usually the way that you show how valuable it is to you is that you shell out some money for it. You say, okay, this thing has value to me. For instance, lots of people worship pop stars. I don't know. Who's the flavor of the week? What did you whisper?
I said race cars.
Who?
I said race car drivers.
Oh, race car drivers. Oh, yeah, they're a big thing right now, aren't they? A lot of people worship all kinds of celebrities. Now, how do we show the value that we invest in those celebrities? Well, we make them phenomenally rich. We make them rich. That's an exchange of value. We show that they are valuable to us by giving them money and making them rich. If you wanted to go see, I don't know, who's the flavor of the week this week? Who's the big pop star these days? If you want to go see...
R. Kelly's got a bunch of number ones.
Okay, there you go. R. Kelly. Ooh. If you want to... if you want to go see R. Kelly, can you go to his house and knock on the door?
No.
If you want to see R. Kelly, what do you got to do? You got to pay. If you want to hear R. Kelly sing, what do you got to do? You got to pay. If you want to see these people, especially if you want to see them perform, it's going to cost you some money. And people will continue to shell out that money because they want to see him do that. It's an exchange of value. Jesus used money as an example in many, many of his parables and his teaching to explain that in this lifetime, in this world, you have an opportunity to demonstrate what is valuable to you. Now, in the 20th century church world, churches have now become less like bodies of believers and more like multinational corporations. You have enormous churches with enormous budgets, their main impetus being get more people in to keep the budget going because we are, after all, a corporation. And pastors have become more like CEOs, especially purpose-driven CEOs, because they're being judged now on the basis not of the truth that they tell or the amount of truth that they convey, but how many people they bring in and how many bodies come through the door and how much money ends up in the plate every week and how many more buildings can we build and how much money comes into the coffers. That is now the determining factor on many, many preachers and pastors. They are more like CEOs than they are actually like shepherds. And so in order to keep that entity of the gigantic church going, they do things to raise money. Raising money, very big deal. Very big. This is all going to tie in a minute to Luke. This is all introduction.
Doesn't count
against my time, exactly. In order to keep a corporate version of church going, there's a certain amount of money that just has to come in because there's a lot of debt going on, there's a lot of buildings going on, there's a lot of stuff going on. So they will encourage you to give by giving you something back, and usually what they give you back is something that will appeal to your pride. They give you back something that appeals to your ego. Have you ever been in the churches where they have plaques with people's names on them? I was in a church in Los Angeles where for, I think it was $10,000, something like that, you get a reserved seat right up front with a little plaque on it with your name so that everybody knows that you're a $10,000 giver. And this is all for the purpose of making you feel good about the money that you've invested so that you can feel better about the notion that you've given something to a church and you're really, really hoping that God is watching and that God knows that you gave $10,000 to a church and then you get to sit down front and everybody praises and honors you because, look, you're one of the big givers. Well, this morning what we're going to bump into in Luke 21 is the absolute antithesis of everything I just described. What we're going to bump into this morning is Jesus standing in the temple and watching the coffer. And he's watching people come and put money in. And people are putting in large sums of money. And Jesus does not speak well of any of them. He doesn't eulogize any of them. He doesn't memorialize any of them except for one little widow. And it's what she does that gets Jesus' attention. And that's where we start in chapter 21, verse 1. And he, Jesus, looked up. He saw rich men casting their gifts into the treasury. Rich men were casting gifts into the treasury. Was Jesus impressed? Doesn't seem to be. He makes no real mention of it outside of the fact that he stands there and watches it happen. And he saw also a certain poor widow. I think it's interesting that both Mark and Luke, who recite this story, point out that she is completely impoverished, destitute. The woman has nothing. He saw a certain widow casting in two mites. That's the old English version. Most of your current versions will say two copper coins.
2 cents.
Yeah, well, it's 1 cent. It was two copper coins that together would have added up to about a penny. And yet what she casted in was everything she had. What she casted in was the sum total of all the money she had. She had two little copper coins that together would have been about a penny. Not enough to live on for more than a day, and she cast it in. And Jesus said, "Of a truth I say unto you that this poor widow has cast in more than they all." All the rich people giving out of their riches, putting money into the coffer. He said, this woman has given more. Now, of course, logically, that makes no sense. You'd say, well, no, this guy gave $10,000 and this guy gave $15,000 and she gave a penny. He said, no, this woman has given more. Here's why. Verse 4, because all of these have of their abundance cast into the offering of God. But she of her poverty, of her penury is the word in the King James Version, she of her poverty has cast in all the living that she has. The way that we approach giving here at GCA is to try to find every biblical example we could find of giving and the exchange of value and try to adjust our approach according to what Scripture says. Consequently, we don't get involved in how much you give. I don't know how much any person gives. I'm not interested in knowing how much any person gives. The secretary of the church knows how much some people give if they write it on a check, but people put cash into the box and nobody else knows, because I am firmly convinced that the only person who needs to know how much you give is God. But to my way of thinking, that actually puts more pressure on you, not less pressure, because God knows. Jesus was standing there watching people put in money, and he knew how much every person gave, and he knew how much every person had. As a consequence, he was not impressed with what anybody gave. But when one widow came along and put in a penny, that was everything she had, and he so memorialized her that we still know about the widow who gave her two mites, and we still talk about her. And we don't talk about any of those rich guys. There's a whole line of rich guys throwing money into the coffer. God, who knows the heart of individuals and who knows the circumstances of all people, knows whether the amount of money anybody gives is actually a sacrifice or not. And there are a great deal of people who give money to churches, and it's no sacrifice to them at all. I've seen folks give $5 to a church. My favorite example of this was, do you remember after 9/11, they had the memorial service, an ecumenical service in the cathedral in Washington. Did anybody watch that? Remember, and the president was there sitting on the front row, and it was truly ecumenical, and they had a rabbi that spoke, and they had a Catholic that spoke, and I think it was Billy Graham's son that spoke, and they all asked God to protect our nation, and they all asked God to protect us against future terrorist attack, and they all asked for God's blessing and his hand of protection, and they were really seriously asking for these things. We had just been attacked. Buildings had just fallen, and they were pleading with God, please, God. And then at the end of the service, they passed the plate, and the cameras followed the plate. And here were the rich and powerful of Washington sitting on the front rows. And here were these preachers of huge denominations and gigantic churches, and the camera followed the plate. And I sat and watched, and it was a dollar and a dollar and five and a dollar, maybe a ten, a dollar. I was outraged. I sat there and watched it and thought, okay, please, God, save our nation. Please, God, help us. Now here comes the exchange of value. What's God worth? I'll give him a buck. I'll give him five. I'll give him less than I'll spend for lunch today. You see, God understands the exchange of value. He did it with this widow. If we learn anything from the story of this widow, it's that God knows how much you have, and he knows whether what you give is a sacrifice or what sort of exchange of value it is. Look, I don't mean to be an affront to you, but it's my job to be honest. If you give, let's say, over the course of a year, $100 to a church, but over the course of that same year, you spend $900 on pop stars. Do I have to finish that sentence? I just watched all your faces, and many of you cringed. Many of you kind of went, yeah. Well, see, you just figured it out. And if you can figure it out, God can figure it out. If you know what your exchange of value has been in the course of the last year, look, I'm not trying to get more money out of you. I don't know how much you give, whatever you put in the box. This church has been very, very blessed. The property next door, this property here, everything, we've paid it off in 4 years. We've been phenomenally blessed. I have no complaint with the way this church is giving, so I'm not trying to pick your pocket. I'm trying to teach you a principle. And the principle is, you're not fooling God. Jesus stood there and watched people put money in, and he was not impressed when rich people put some money in. They could put large sums in and still have it be nothing. Listen, if Scott gave $10,000 this week, that would be a lot for Scott. We'd be impressed. The secretary would look at the check and go, I'm impressed. That would be a lot for Scott to do. If Bill Gates gave $10,000, would we be impressed?
Not really.
Was that any kind of sacrifice for him to write a $10,000 check? No, he could write that in his sleep. He'd never feel it. That'd be like me dropping a penny and not caring to pick it up. I mean, it's that kind of thing. So we understand that. We get that. Everybody in the room got that example. Everybody in the room went, oh, Bill Gates, sure. You don't think God can figure that out? God knows exactly how much he has blessed you. He knows exactly how much he has provided for you. You know, Jesus said, your Father in heaven knows what things you have need of. Throughout the Old and New Testament, there are only two things considered necessary. There are only two things that the Bible says are the necessities of life that God has promised to always provide you with. What are those two things?
Food and raiment.
Food and clothing is all the Bible has ever promised you. Food and raiment. Do you have more than one change of raiment? Sure you do. Most of you have closets full. Oh, the women in the back. I'm going to guess that the women not only have closets full, but extra boxes full of stuff they don't wear, but they haven't given away yet, that they have tucked away in the closet in case their weight changes later. Right? Oh, man. Oh. So I have to ask the question then. Are you blessed? Sure, if all God promised you is food for today, take no thought for tomorrow. The things of tomorrow will care for themselves. Sufficient for the day is the trouble thereof. So all you're promised is today, and enough food for today. As thy day, so shall thy strength be. You're given the promise that you're going to get through today. God's going to care for today, and you have no promise you'll even be here tomorrow. He's going to provide you food for today and something to wear. Do you know where today's food is coming from? Do you have enough money in your pocket to feel pretty confident that you're going to eat today? Do you have enough money in your fridge? Enough money in your fridge. If you have money in your fridge, there's something very wrong with you.
I'm sorry.
Tickled James. Do you have enough food in your refrigerator today that you know that you have enough to eat today? Then you are phenomenally blessed. If you have more than one change of raiment, you have enough food to see your way clear through today and tomorrow, you're ahead of 90% of the people on planet Earth. If you live in an air-conditioned home, as every one of you do, you're ahead of 90% of the people on planet Earth. Most of you drive in air-conditioned cars to go to your air-conditioned house, where you have refrigerators full of food and another refrigerator full of money, and you have plenty of clothes in your closet. You have plenty of everything. Most of us, our children are healthy. We have access to the best health care in the history of the world, and we can drive through and pick up the highest quality food in the history of the world for $5 or less. We're blessed. We're so blessed. We're so phenomenally blessed. We are so well cared for as a people. And we give back to God a tip. We usually give him less than we would give a waiter who brought us our food at O'Charley's. Because that's the exchange of value. And if you get that and I get that, God gets that. And again, Jesus understood it. He saw this widow walk up and give what you or I wouldn't consider bending over to pick up. It's insignificant. To this woman, it was everything. And when she put it in the coffer and gave it to God, she gave away everything she had. And all of those rich people would have said, she gave nothing. She gave a penny. Nothing. And yet to Jesus, he memorialized her because it was everything. And who do you think of all those people? Who do you think God smiled on the most that day? The men who tipped him out of their riches or the woman who gave everything? Obviously, the woman who gave everything. Now, I refuse to believe, and it doesn't say anything in the Bible about what happened to her. It says absolutely nothing about her, but we know this. Jesus memorialized her, and 2,000 years later, we're still talking about her. I'm prone to believe that the same God who sent Elijah to a widow, that widow and her son were expecting to die. They were going to eat their last meal. She was picking up sticks to make the last meal, and they were going to lay down and die. And as long as Elijah the prophet was with her, she never ran out of meal, never ran out of oil all through the drought. That's the same God who's walking in shoe leather here, memorializing this widow who gave her everything. I'm prone to believe that that woman was well taken care of after that. I'm prone to believe that if Jesus recognized that she gave everything, that God, from his hand of sovereignty and his heart of grace, would have made sure that that woman was cared for. That's what I believe. Turn over to Mark for a second, Mark 12. Now, I'm not trying to make anybody feel guilty. What you give, you give. What you contribute. It's between you and God. But don't pretend that you can fool God. God knows what you have because God's the one who gave it to you. He knows how much you have and he knows how much you give. Look at Mark 12, starting at verse 41. This is the parallel story. Mark and Luke are the only two of the synoptic gospel writers that include this story. Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. Now, those details that Mark gives us I find really intriguing, because that says that Jesus, on purpose, walked over to the place in the temple. And remember, you're talking about a very large building here and a very large courtyard outside and thousands of people milling around. Remember that Passover is coming. Every man who could travel was required to be in Jerusalem at that time. So this is a very crowded temple at the time. And the place where Jesus chose to position himself was by the treasury so that he could stand there and watch people put money in. He chose to stand there and watch people give money. And many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. Again, two copper coins that make less than a penny. And Mark throws in this detail that Luke doesn't include. He called his disciples to him and gathered them around. He said, come here. I want to show you something. This is an object lesson that he passed on to his disciples. So clearly it's an object lesson that he wants passed on to those who follow him. That's why I'm putting the emphasis on it, because Jesus put emphasis on it. He called his disciples over and he pointed her out. And said, verily I say unto you, that this poor widow has cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in from their abundance. But she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. So clearly he wanted us, his followers, his disciples, to recognize and understand that this woman gave more, because if you're God, then the cattle on 1,000 hills are yours, right? If you're God, you own the universe. You created it. You spoke it into existence. It all belongs to you, right? So then really, what does gold matter to God? Doesn't. What does money matter to God?
Value that we're attaching to his worth.
Absolutely. It's an exchange of value that we people, we humans, utilize. But does God need your money? No. No. God said, if I were hungry, I would not tell you. God does whatever he wants to do with everything he owns because it is all his. So does your giving toward the work of the gospel or toward a church or toward any kind of ministerial work or even giving to the poor, does that in any way enrich God? No. Does building an enormous edifice enrich God? Does building a gigantic theatrical church complete with surround sound and smoke machines, does that enrich God?
Nope.
No, of course not. He's God. He doesn't need any of that. So then does he need for you to give him anything?
No.
Then why does he talk so much about giving?
Because
you need
to give.
You need to give. It's not that he needs to get. He has it all. He owns it all. He owns you. He owns everything you have. And he knows that when you die, everything you have, you leave behind. Nothing you have is permanent. It comes through your hands for a little while, and then it's gone. When Bill Gates dies, how much does he leave behind?
All of it.
All of it. And then everybody fights over it. When he stands before God, and he will, what will he have to show for himself? It won't be about his money. Because as Paul would state, the love of money, not money itself, but the love of money, is the root of all kinds of evil. And God doesn't need your money, you need to give. Now let's extrapolate on that for a moment. We had two guys who got it right, who both said, you need to give. Why? Why do you need to give?
To show what value you place in it.
To show what value you place in it. That's the right answer. Absolutely. It's an exchange of value. We use money as an exchange of value in everything we do. The clothes you wear, you bought for a certain amount of money that you determined was the proper price for what you bought. It's an exchange of value. How valuable is God to you in your life? How much has he given you? How much has he provided for you? And what then is he worth in your life? You need to give as an act of sacrifice, as an act of worship, to show God that he is valuable in your life and that you recognize the manifold blessings that you live with. And we've already established that everybody in this room is phenomenally blessed. So, did I say anything so far that the Bible hasn't said? Just make sure. Well, then you're on the hook. If you say that you believe in God, and if you say that you believe you're blessed by God, and if you believe that you've been saved through Christ, then the expectation is throughout the Bible, whether it was sacrificing animals under the Mosaic system, or whether it's giving to the support of the gospel in the New Testament, the expectation is that you will sacrifice to the work of the ministry and the ongoing worship of God. You got all that? Okay, having said that, we can move on. That then takes us to verse 5. In verse 5, even though Jesus has just pointed out that this widow gave more than everybody else, the folks he's with are nevertheless very impressed with the temple. And this temple is a magnificent temple. The temple that he's in at this moment is not Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar during the Babylonish incursion into Jerusalem. It had been leveled, but then under Herod, previous to Jesus' appearance, Herod the Great, Herod had built a temple in that area, primarily to curry favor with the Jews that lived in that area. Herod himself was an Idumean. He was not a Jew. And Herod had many magnificent building projects in the 40 years leading up to Jesus' appearance on planet Earth. He built phenomenal causeways and brought in irrigation systems and built this fabulous temple. And it really was an amazing structure that Herod had built. Well, the folks that Jesus was with in the temple were so impressed with it that in verse 5, some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts. Now, that's a very truncated version of what was actually taking place at that moment. So turn over to Matthew 24, and let's look at Matthew's account of what they said to him as he was entering the temple. Matthew 24, verse 1. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the building of the temple. They all thought it was just a really grand temple. Look at Mark 13. I know you're flipping around a bit, but look at all the parallels here, and then we can fill in the blanks. Mark 13, verse 1 says, "And as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples came to him and said, 'Master, see what manner of stones and what a building this is.'" So they were all quite impressed with this temple that Herod had built. And they were hoping that Jesus was going to be impressed with it because he had just talked about the rich men putting money into the treasury. And I don't think it's a mistake that Luke juxtaposed this story against the story of the widow. All these people were putting money into the coffers. He points out that the widow put in her whole living, and they say, "Yes, but with all this money that's coming in, look at what a great place we've built. Look at this magnificent temple. Look at these stones. Look at the gems. Look at how wonderful this place is." And they thought he'd be impressed. They thought he'd say, "Oh, well, then the money is well spent. I mean, well, look at all this. Oh, clearly you've really built something magnificent for God here." Yes. His response is, "As for these things which you behold, the days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." So while they were trying to impress him with the magnificent edifice of Herod's temple, he turned to them and said, "Yes, but the day is coming when it will be leveled. It will be nothing. It will be destroyed." Now, why was it necessary that that temple be destroyed? Israel had a long history of rebelling against God. And as a consequence of their long rebellion against God, he had put them into several different captivities. And even though the northern 10 tribes, what are classically called Israel or what are called Ephraim, the 10 northern tribes were taken into the Assyrian captivity, and as most of you know from our Wednesday night studies, after the Assyrian captivity, never made it back to Canaan. They never came back and regathered in the land that God gave them when they came out of Egypt. Then comes the Babylonish captivity, and during Nebuchadnezzar's time, even the southern kingdom were taken into Babylon, and then Babylon was conquered by Medo-Persia, and Cyrus the Persian king was predicted in Isaiah 150 years in advance that he was going to let the people come back and rebuild the temple and rebuild their streets and rebuild the city and the wall under perilous times. Cyrus comes along and he actually does that. Why was it so necessary for God to keep the southern kingdom intact? It's because the promise was to Judah and the southern kingdom that through them was going to come the Messiah. The scepter and lawgiving would not depart from Judah until Shiloh would come, whose right it was to reign, and the gathering of the nations would be unto him. So Judah, the southern kingdom, had to remain intact until Shiloh came, until Messiah came, until Jesus came. So the northern kingdoms are scattered with the promise of being regathered, but the southern kingdom remained intact until Jesus came. Now Jesus has come. Is there any more reason to keep the southern kingdom intact? No. Are they finally going to fall under the same judgment that the northern kingdom fell under? So this temple is a monument to Moses. This temple is a monument to the Mosaic law, to the continual sacrifice of animals, and to people trying to approach God through the Mosaic system and the constant sin sacrifice, the constant flow of blood. All of that is represented in that temple. And now Christ has come. And so that temple system and the system of slicing animals open as sin offerings is no longer going to be valid because Jesus is going to die what the book of Hebrews calls the once and for all sacrifice for sin. And once that's accomplished, there's no more need for the Mosaic system. The law has been done away with. The Mosaic slicing of animals for sin is done away with. The priesthood is done away with. Approaching God once a year on the Day of Atonement behind the curtain, that's done away with, which was represented in the reality that when Jesus died, when he cried out and gave up the ghost, it says that the temple curtain was torn open from the top to the bottom, not to let him out, to let us in. Now the way to God had been made manifest. It was through Jesus Christ and no longer through that sacrificial system. So there's no more need for the temple. But there was so much Mosaic worship going on in the temple and so many people who worshiped the temple itself that it was time for Christ to change their perspective, to change their view, and to change what they worshiped. So he came, he lived, he died. 70 AD, in comes the Roman army. God's providential hand of protection had held the armies of the world outside of Jerusalem. It's one of those great mysteries of history, how it is that little area, this little sliver of land, Israel, that all of their enemies in the Middle East have never been able to successfully just push them off into the sea that they'd been trying to do for hundreds of years and just be rid of these Jews, just get rid of that nation that calls themselves the people of God. If we could just destroy them once and for all and get them off the earth, then we don't have to be bothered by them anymore. God's providential hand of protection kept Jerusalem intact all those years till Jesus came, and finally in 70 AD, Titus, the Roman general, steamed in there, and there were rumors that between the stones of the temple that there was gold hidden and that there were treasures hidden, and sure enough, the armies came in, and when they got done, they had leveled the temple until there was not one stone standing on another. Exactly like Jesus had said. And from that day until now, there hasn't been a temple rebuilt on that site. And in fact, it's where the dome, the temple, the Mosque of Omar is at this very moment up on the Temple Mount. And all that's left of that temple is the Wailing Wall, where the Jews still go and insert their prayers and pray, because that's what's left of that old system. God completely knocked that system down in favor of Christ, because he is now the way to God. He is now the sufficient once-for-all sacrifice. He is now our mercy seat. His blood flowed, so no other blood has to flow. And we are now saved by grace through faith, not of works, lest any man should boast. Consequently, there is no more need for the law or the legal system or the system of Moses, and it's all been removed. Got all that? I know those were just huge leaps that it's taken us years of teaching to kind of build up to, where I could speak all that in shorthand and you all went, yep, I'm still with you, Jim. But for those of you who had trouble keeping up, it's all on tape in the back room. So take you about 3 years. Just you know. So they ask him naturally. I'm back in Luke 21 now. Here he has predicted that this magnificent structure is going to fall. He's predicted that this structure is going to be demolished to the point where not one stone is left on another. If you heard that, the very next thing you're going to ask is, when? When is that going to happen, Jesus? And how is that all going to happen? Look at this place. This is a phenomenal structure. How is it all going to be so completely leveled, and when is that going to happen? Verse 7, and they asked him, saying, Master, but when shall these things be, and what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? And that's an interesting version of the question. Keep your finger there. Go back to Matthew 24 for a second. Matthew fills in a few blanks in that question. Matthew 24 is the most eschatological passage of the four Gospels. You know what that means, eschatological? Everybody in the room okay with that? Or did I just dust a few people? Eschatology, eschaton, Greek word for last things. Eschaton, last things. Eschatology, study of last things. So when we use the word eschatology, we're talking about last things, prophecy, end of the world. There's a whole lot of prophecy in the Bible. The Bible is, in fact, chock full of prophecy, because it's one of the ways that God proves his absolute sovereignty over all things. God proves his sovereignty over all things by saying, I will now tell you what's going to happen 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 1,000 years from now, at the end of the world. And then sure enough, we have enough history behind us now that we can take the Bible and compare when it was written, what it said, and then what actually happened. Like the tearing down of the temple in Jerusalem, we have all this evidence that the prophecy in the Bible is true and that everything God has said so far has come to pass. And that gives us a great deal of confidence that everything else he has said is going to come to pass. And so Wednesday nights here, we've been studying prophecy and eschatology. So Matthew 24 is a very eschatological chapter. Matthew 24 starts with Jesus went out, they departed from him out of the temple. His disciples came to show him the building of the temple, and he said, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world?" So there's actually two questions being asked there. They want to know, when's the temple going to be knocked down? And what are going to be the signs of the end of the world? There's a lot of prophecy in the Old Testament, in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, in Jeremiah, that talks about the end of the world. New heaven, new earth, a time of the restoration of all Israel, a time when God is going to write his law in the hearts of all the Israelites. He's going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, a time when none of them will have to teach his brother or say, "Know the Lord, for they will all know me from the least to the greatest. I will be their God. They will be my people." All of that kind of language. Well, that's what they're asking him here. Okay, we've got all these prophecies, Jesus, talking about the end of the world and the end of time. We want to know two things. When are you going to knock down the temple? And what are going to be the signs of the end of the world? So when we talk about eschatology, end things, it's not a completely foreign concept. Even Jesus' disciples came and asked him, "Tell us more about eschatology. Tell us about end stuff." Now, Matthew 24 has a lot more detail in it than Luke 21 does. Luke is writing to Gentiles. And so Luke picks out those parts of Jesus' statements that he thinks apply to his Gentile audience. Matthew includes much more detail, but he includes a whole lot of information about Israel and about the Jews and about Jerusalem and about what's going to happen to those particular people, because that's his audience. Matthew is the most Jewish of the four Gospels, and so he includes a lot of Jewish information and a lot of references to Old Testament scripture that Luke knows his audience isn't going to understand. So Luke doesn't include that stuff. So we've gone through Matthew 24 fairly extensively in our Wednesday night and midweek studies, so on Sunday mornings I'm not going to bog down on that because it would take us a couple weeks to get through it. We're just going to concentrate on Luke's telling of it, recognizing that Luke has left out some of the information that is in Matthew 24. Got all that? I'm in chapter 21 of Luke, verse 7. "Master, but when shall these things be? And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass?" He says, "Take heed that ye be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and the time draws near. Go ye not therefore after them." The reason Jesus told them, don't follow false messiahs, false prophets, and certainly during the first century within Judaism, you can read historically, there were a great many false messiahs that people followed, that all had gatherings, that all had different prophecies, that all had different descriptions of how the world was going to wrap up. Every one of those messiahs, over the course of time, every one of them died, and then they're lost to history. We know a little bit about them. Some of the early Jewish writers write about them. And then they're lost to history. They're gone, and their group splits up because their leader's dead. Jesus is the only person to appear on the stage of history and declare himself to be Messiah, who was also killed and then rose. And as a consequence, his following, what we call Christianity, what they called the Way, continued and expanded and grew even under pain of persecution and death because he was telling the truth. He was the actual real Messiah, and his death and resurrection proved all that. So when he answers questions like, "What will be the signs of your coming?" he doesn't just talk in minutia. He says when he comes back that the sun and the moon will be darkened. He says when he returns that the stars won't give their light and the whole sky will be blackened, and then the sign of the return of the Son of Man is going to appear in the sky as lightning is from the east to the west. That's the kind of language he used to describe his return. So you can see why he would say, "Others will come in my name and say, 'I am Christ.' But if they say to you, 'He's out in the desert,' don't believe them. And if they say he's in the inner chamber, go see him. Don't believe them. Because when Christ comes back, it's not going to be a very small, limited occurrence somewhere in a pocket of the world hidden away somewhere. It's going to be the return in majesty of the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. It's going to be a return that nobody on earth can in any way question or decry. It's going to be the return in majesty. So he tells his followers here, there will be many who will come and say, I am Christ, and the time draws near, but go ye not therefore after them. Because his return is going to be obvious. His return is going to be huge. But when ye shall hear of wars and commotions, don't be terrified. For these things must first come to pass, but the end is not yet. Then he said unto them, nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. That's ethnos against ethnos, ethnic group against ethnic group. We've seen a lot of that lately, haven't we? People of the same general ethnicity fighting each other, tribal warfare. Great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, famines and pestilences. In fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. Then he turns to his disciples who have asked that question. He's just given them a scope of history. He has just said, okay, there's going to be a lot of stuff that's going to happen. There's going to be war. There's going to be a lot of bad stuff. There's going to be earthquakes, earthquakes in diverse places. There's going to be all kinds of signs in the heaven. There's going to be a lot of trouble on planet Earth. But that's not the end yet. Let me be real clear here. Late great planet Earth, notwithstanding all those end time sensationalistic books that are out there that make a great deal of the earthquakes and the wars and the famines and the floods and the things that are going on the earth, Jesus said, those aren't the sign. Jesus said, those things will happen, but the end is not yet. There's only one sign of Christ's return. And I just described it to you. That the sun and the moon are going to be darkened and the stars are not going to give their light. And then, specific language, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens as the lightning is from the east to the west. Everybody on earth is going to see the sign of his return. And that's what they were asking him. What will be the sign of your return? That word sign is actually miracle. What is going to be the miraculous sign of your return? He said, well, there's going to be a lot of stuff. There's going to be earthquakes. There's going to be famines. There's going to be floods, wars, pestilences. All of that's going to happen, but that's not the end yet. The end of the world is going to come when the sign of the Son of Man appears in heaven. When Christ himself returns, then you know that it's time to wrap things up. Everything else is just building up to it. It's just the birth pangs leading up to the creation of the new heaven and the new earth, but none of those are the sign. And they were all looking to know what is the sign. Great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, and famines and pestilences and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven. But, now speaking directly to his disciples that were there with him, contemporary to that moment, he said, but before all these, before all that stuff I described, they shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Did that happen? Yeah. Every one of his 12, with the exception of Judas, were brought before synagogues, kings, rulers, and every one of them were condemned. Every one of them died terrible deaths for their testimony of Jesus Christ. Every one of them were persecuted, were brought before leaders, rulers, kings, the leaders of the temple, and every one of them were told, shut up or die. Stop preaching this thing about a risen Christ or die. And he told them, that's what's going to happen to you. And that's going to happen before all that stuff. So there's even a little irony here, because they've asked him, when are you going to knock down the temple, and what's going to be the sign of your coming? Leading me to believe, based on the question, that they thought they were going to be here for it. They were like, you know, what should we be looking for? What should we be watching for so that we can see it when you're coming back? When are you going to set up the kingdom? When are you going to reestablish Israel? When are you going to do all this stuff? And he says, well, there's going to be a lot of stuff on earth. And there's going to be wars and pestilences and nation upon nation. There's going to be earthquakes in diverse places. There's going to be floods. There's going to be all that's going to happen. But before all that happens, and all of that precedes the sign of my return, and before all that happens, every one of you is going to be killed. So really, you're not going to be here to see it. You're going to be persecuted for my name's sake because he always made himself the center of the religious universe. It was always about him. And he redirected their thinking back to him. You're going to be a testimony of me. And that's what he says in the next verse. And it shall turn to you for a testimony. They will go out and testify of Christ. They would go out and testify of what they knew and what they had learned, and they would die for it. And their death would precede all that other stuff they were asking about. So you'll be brought before synagogues, kings, put into prison, all of this for my name's sake. It's going to turn to you for a testimony, so settle it therefore in your hearts. Not to meditate beforehand what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. And you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. You shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, and there shall not a hair of your head perish. In your patience possess you your souls. A couple quick points, we'll wrap it up. First off, did he preach to them the wealth and prosperity gospel?
No.
No, he said to them, you're going to be hated of all men for my name's sake. Because you represent me, because you are aligned with me, because you're going to preach my gospel, you're going to be hated by a world that doesn't understand that. He didn't say, now that you've come to me and made me your Lord and Savior, now that you've chosen me and invited me into your heart, you're never going to get sick and you're going to have plenty of money and everything's going to go your way. That's the popular gospel out there today. It's not the one Jesus preached. He said, for my name's sake, you're going to be persecuted, you're going to be killed, and you're going to be hated of all men for my name's sake. Because Jesus always made a division between himself, his people, and the world. And he said, they hated me without a cause. They're going to hate you without a cause. But the world cannot hate its own. They hate Christians. They hate Christ because we represent everything they're afraid of. We condemn them of their sin. We make obvious that there is a God. They don't want to know that. So they're going to hate you for that. The other thing I wanted to point out here is that he told his apostles, when the time comes to speak, don't worry your hearts about what you're going to speak. He said, you're going to be brought in front of kings, you're going to be brought in front of rulers, and I know you're very worried about what you're going to say at that moment. He makes it clear that it's not them that's going to be speaking. He said, my spirit, the spirit of God speaking through you, will make the argument for you in a way that even your enemies are not going to be able to gainsay. They're going to come to recognize that what you're saying is not only true, but it's what you're convinced of as the truth, and they're not going to be able to talk you out of it. And I've had folks many times say to me, in fact, Carol and I have had conversations about it, and she just wrote a little bit about it on the Sovereign Grace Place chat room, just wrote a little bit about that terror that we all have when we have an opportunity to stand up for Christ, have that opportunity to speak to somebody about Christ, about our faith, why we believe what we believe, trying to follow the example that we're given to be ready to give an answer to every man who inquires about the faith that is within us. And if you're laying in your bed at night thinking about it, it's kind of a scary thing, knowing that there's a world out there that hates the God that we worship and who resists the Christ that saved us. And it's kind of a frightening thing to think that we're going to be willing to put our own necks on the line and stand up and speak the words of truth and say, this is what I believe, especially if you happen to be Sovereign Grace Christians. Then not only does the world hate you, but you get all this resistance from the rest of the church world because you're willing to say that the God of the Bible chooses and the God of the Bible is sovereign and that he's on his throne doing whatever he pleases. That the God of the Bible elects people to eternal life because he does whatever appeals to his good pleasure. He's on his throne doing whatever he wants. Well, that'll even get you in trouble in Christian circles. So you say, what am I supposed to say? How am I supposed to say it? Why am I supposed to do it? Well, I can reassure you the same way that Jesus reassured his apostles. It's been my experience, and I think most of the people in the room would agree, that it won't be you doing it anyway. If the Spirit of God is inhabiting you, then he will create opportunities for you to speak about him. And when he creates those opportunities, he'll also give you the words to speak. Is there anybody in the room that can testify that that's true? That you've had those experiences, you've had those moments where nervous as you were when you got done talking, you went, wow, where did that come from? Wow, I knew what to say. I knew the answers. I had the Bible right there at the tip of my fingers. How did that happen? Well, the answer is it was God doing it, because he's the one in charge. And he will use you as the conduit to reach other people who he's determined to reach. And he will use you to proclaim his gospel of free and sovereign grace to the people he is in the process of saving and the people he is in the process of setting free, people he's in the process of sanctifying. He'll use you the same way he used his apostles and disciples and followers. And when the time comes, he'll put the words in you. And the words will work through you and you'll speak the truth. Because that way, all the glory goes back to him. That way you don't get to say, wow, wasn't I clever? Talk somebody into the kingdom. It's another notch on my belt. Got another one saved today. It's not going to be you doing it. It'll be the very God that called you that's calling that person, that designed your life in such a way that your paths are going to cross for the very purpose of using you to speak to that person to introduce them to the reality of God. If you haven't had that experience yet in your Christian walk, you will. Wait, God does not save you and redeem you and teach you and buy you and indwell you so that he can put you on a shelf and go, now wait there, I'll get back to you. He puts you into service. He puts you into the service of the proclamation and forward movement of his gospel and the expansion of his kingdom of grace. So that's what he said to his apostles, and I think it rings true to everybody in this room. If you trust in God and his Spirit, he'll give you the words to speak when the time comes.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.